Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. The war is, of course, well underway on myriad fronts, and who better to take stock of all of this with than a particularly intelligent man with whom we have the privilege of interacting from time to time and who has graciously agreed to give us a full hour of his time for a proper intelligence briefing today. He is, actually, a man with long and serious credentials in the intelligence business, a former Central Intelligence Agency operations officer for some 20 years with service in the Middle East, South Asia, and Europe. He ultimately finished up his time at the agency in charge of its Weapons of Mass Destruction Terrorism Office, where he was overseeing some of the most serious threats of our time, including, presumably, biological warfare against us. He is a former candidate for Congress, a defense contractor, Army tank officer, and judge advocate general, a former assistant attorney general in Washington State, a man of incredible credentials, and an author of a number of books, including one particularly important one and relevant perhaps to our time, Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. His name, of course, is Charles Sam Faddis, a good friend and valued contributor to this program. Sam, it's good to have you, and thank you for giving us a full hour of your time. I want to talk to you about something that you've written most recently at And Magazine, the outfit that you contribute to regularly. It has to do with the coronavirus and what we are learning both about it and about the agency that is principally responsible for helping us contend with such calamities, namely the Center for Disease Control. Give us a flavor, as you see it, Sam, of where we are now with respect to this disease, this pandemic, and the degree to which the CDC is seemingly complicit in compounding some of those problems.
Right. Well, I don't think there's any question, unfortunately, that the Centers for Disease Control completely fumbled certainly the issue of test kits in regard to this virus early on. And it's one of those situations where I think what you have is just, unfortunately, it's the stereotypical bureaucratic situation, which is to say that they recognized many, many, many weeks ago that they had a couple of choices. And one choice was to go with existing World Health Organization test kits, maybe not their preferred choice, but they were in existence and they could be taken off the shelf and utilized. Or they could choose what only a bureaucrat would choose, which is, let's invent a brand new test kit in the middle of a crisis, forbid anybody else from playing in the game. They directed a number of labs around the country to stand down on efforts to develop kits. And then let's funnel all test results through one single lab in Atlanta. Anybody who would listen to that explanation who lives in the real world would understand the brand new test is going to have all sorts of growing pains. Funneling all the test results through one lab is going to be a debacle. And that's exactly what happened. So now the president has stepped in. He's cut a lot of red tape. A lot of things have changed. We are now moving with dispatch. But in the meantime, we've lost time that we already didn't have in the middle of a crisis. And to me, this is just an example of exactly what happens in a bureaucracy, right? This is what happens when you have people who live in this abstract, almost academic kind of world, and not in the real world where most of us have to live.
Live and die, as the case may be, in a pandemic situation. And what you've said in your piece, Sam, which I thought very succinctly captured the nub of the problem, is that we need a government that does its job and that is, as you put it, field accountable for failures. Tell us what field accountability is. You've certainly had to exercise it during your years in the field for the Central Intelligence Agency. But what do you mean by that expression, and how far off that mark are we now?
Well, I mean, you know, this is mission accomplishment. This is, look, there's only one standard here, and the standard is we actually have to achieve our objective at the end of the day. You have to accomplish the mission. That you can produce a briefing or a PowerPoint presentation or a spreadsheet or hold 12 meetings on a topic is not the measure of success. The measure of success is, did we or did we not field the necessary number of test kits in the required time to do our duty to the people of the United States? The answer to that manifestly is no. We dropped the ball 100% on that. And this is the essence of the problem with our federal government writ large. This is just an example. A lot of abstract thought, a lot of money thrown at problems. And in fact, we see the predictable reaction already, as you would expect. So now that it is clear that the CDC failed, the answer is not that we need to fire some people, enforce accountability, and make them do their jobs. The answer is, of course, they need a bigger budget, more people. Once upon a time, if you failed in the accomplishment of your mission, you got sacked, and we found somebody that could get the job done. Now, if you fail in the accomplishment of your mission, apparently we hand you a bigger budget, build a new building, hand you more personnel, and effectively reward you for failure. Nobody gets fired. I mean, the head of the CDC, quite frankly, I'm sorry, should have vacated his office some weeks ago and be looking for a new job. That's clear.
And if you don't hold people accountable, Sam, what is the practical effect? I mean, the old adage, I think, was Einstein, that, you know, you're going to find yourself repeating the same practices and expecting different results, only you won't get them. Is that your experience as well?
100%. I mean, you're just exactly right. You're going to continue to do the same thing over and over and project and expect a different result. Definition of insanity. Right. That's exactly where we are.
And you've called for transforming the culture. Again, you've spent enough time in the belly of the beast to know how hard that is. What are you calling for there? And what are the practical likelihood we could accomplish it?
Well, as you are well aware, the reality is that the President of the United States doesn't simply sit down in the Oval Office and take charge of the government and it runs. You know, he just issues orders. That most Americans are now well aware that it's a lot more complicated than that. The real way the President of the United States takes control of the office is by appointing a minimum of 4,000 top executives who then begin the process of actually putting their hands on the machine. We're probably 3 years behind in that process because the president spent three years just fighting for survival with everybody lined up against him. So we're sort of now at year one of the Trump administration in that respect. He's got to put in place all those guys and gals, and then they've got to start just pounding this principle of accountability and a change of culture into every agency in Washington. No, if you completely drop the ball, don't come to me and tell me you need more money. You're going to be cleaning out your desk, and I'm going to find somebody who will get the job done for the American people, because that's what you do.
That's how you transform the culture, for sure. But it does take time, and we are behind the power curve big time in this pandemic moment especially. Sam, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to ask you about some of the other places in the world where this coronavirus is appearing and what that suggests may be a much bigger problem than the one we're facing even at the moment here. Right after this with Sam Pattis, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are speaking with Charles Sam Pattis, a former career Central Intelligence Agency clandestine operative, among many other accomplishments. He is the author of Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, among other books. And Sam, you were just laying out pretty, I think, devastating indictment of the Centers for Disease Control and sort of more generally how government tends to operate at this moment and the absence of real accountability. I wanted to pivot from that to talking about some of the other places where this disease has been manifesting itself and some of the forces that may be at work behind its spread. Specifically, I wanted to ask you about Iran. You've written about it a lot. You've worked against the Iranians in various theaters. You understand, I think, very well the character of that regime. It apparently is being really rocked by the coronavirus pandemic, the Wuhan flu, or Wu flu, as I favor to call it. When you look at what's going on in Iran, Sam, apparently including afflictions of some senior members of the Iranian regime with this disease, what does it tell you about the probability that this country, of all countries in the Middle East, is probably afflicted in this severe way because of its close ties to China, the source of this Wuhan virus?
So I think it's unquestionably true that the Iranians are paying the price for their ties with China. Let's start with this. This is a single point of contact, but a significant one. They continue to this day, as of the day we're talking, to run multiple daily flights back and forth between Iran and China via their one of their many state-owned airlines. They have never turned that off. Periodically, they've claimed they have. It's not true. They're continuing to do that. They continue to shuttle people back and forth. And they have contact in a number of other ways. So they continue to pump that virus straight into Iran all day, every day, because they won't shut that down. Then you add to that the incredible ignorance and incompetence of their control mechanisms, and there's no great surprise that people are dropping like flies over there.
And Sam, if the Chinese are particularly close to the Iranians and the Iranians are particularly irresponsible about trying to, shall we say, put some social distance between them and the Chinese, would you expect that governments elsewhere in the world that have a similar, if not exactly as intense, a similar relationship with the Chinese? I'm thinking specifically of the scores of countries now that are part of what Xi Jinping calls his Belt and Road Initiative, may be in similar jeopardy if they're not already manifesting the worst of this disease as of yet.
Yeah, without question. And then we could look, I mean, the Chinese, as you well know, are extremely active all across Africa and Latin America and a host of places where they've got just endless projects going on. So they're continuing to shuttle people in and out of those locations every day. And you're just pumping that virus into all these locations where, of course, the health system is really barely struggling to survive in most of these places on any given day. Cannot begin to accommodate what's coming. I mean, wait till this virus begins to burn its way through sub-Saharan Africa. If Italy can't handle it, I guarantee you Nigeria cannot.
And alas, Nigeria is afflicted with another kind of disease. It's called Sharia supremacism, and it's killing large numbers of people already, let alone what might be in the works now, among other places, of course, in Africa and elsewhere. Sam, one of the other things that I imagine has caught your eye about this disease and the Chinese involvement in it is they are now increasingly brazenly blaming the United States for the Wuhan flu, which, of course, the World Health Organization and others have refrained from describing it as a sop to the Chinese and their insistence that they, you know, were not directly responsible. But what are we to make of the efforts the Chinese are now mounting through various propaganda and official government channels to promote this notion that it's actually American military personnel who went to Wuhan in, I believe it was October of 2019, to participate in military games there, who brought it to China and are responsible for what has happened to the Chinese and others?
Well, I think the good news is, if you can use that kind of phrase in this context, is that what we now have is the opportunity to sort of look at the Chinese regime, the Communist Party, in its true face and see the reality of who it is we climbed into bed with 30 years ago when we went down this road of globalization and trade and opening up and whatever tagline you want to stick on it. This is an evil, horrible, despotic regime capable of virtually anything. Yes, in the midst of this crisis, which was made infinitely worse at a minimum by their actions, if they, even assuming it is a naturally occurring event, even in the midst of this crisis, they are capable of just simply lying through their teeth to the entire world. In the meantime, by the way, we have other Chinese officials saying things, sort of muttering under their breath to the effect of, you better be careful or we might cut off the flow of medical supplies and pharmaceuticals to the United States in the middle of this virus, this pandemic. This is who we're dealing with. This is the reality of this regime. And we ought to take it, you know, we come out the other side of this pandemic, wake up to the fact that, okay, we really should not have these connections to and this involvement with a horrible totalitarian regime. We should change this.
Sam Faddis, you alluded to something there that I did want to just update on. As I mentioned earlier in my introduction to you, you have some serious credentials in the biological warfare defense space, specifically having served in the Central Intelligence Agency, trying to monitor what people are doing in this regard, threatening us or potentially doing so. What is your current reading on the likelihood that, in fact, this disease was engineered in perhaps the Institute of Virology in Wuhan, associated with their covert and illegal biological weapons program in China?
Well, we start with this. I think there's a whole lot of evidence out there that suggests very, very strongly that the story about the whole seafood market being the epicenter of this thing is nonsense. And it's at least as likely, if not more likely, that the point of origin is this biological research lab that you alluded to. Whether or not that means, in fact, this is somehow to some degree or another weaponized, or it is simply a virus they were working with that got loose on them, you know, that potentially is a point of discussion. But at a minimum, there is enough here that the world needs an absolute full international accounting, not something that the ridiculous Communist Party tells us they determine, but something that independent experts determine as to exactly what just happened. Now, what's the likelihood that the Chinese Communist Party is going to ever let that happen? I'm not holding my breath for that, but that's what we ought to all demand. No, you let some international folks come in here, research this thing, and give us a real answer on what just happened, because there's a very strong likelihood that your biological weapons program just got loose and is running rampant around the world.
And in terms of the performance of this disease, does that reinforce your concerns that I'm told that, you know, scientific experts have concluded that there is something anomalous about this disease's DNA or genome or whatever it is that hasn't occurred in nature heretofore? Have you heard that? And does, again, if not the microbiology of the thing, the performance of it suggests that this may have been indeed engineered?
Well, there are absolutely studies that have said that an examination of this thing suggests that it basically was spliced together from different diseases. I don't pretend to, as based on my level of expertise, to be able to pass judgment on that, but these are not quacks. These are not some guy in the street corner ranting and raving. We're talking about major scientific studies, so that's a definite issue. Absolutely. The way it works certainly has characteristics that would be consistent with a biological weapon. If you, you know, in that sick world, you're looking for something that spreads rapidly, ultimately is very effective, but doesn't kill its host too quickly, because the host has to be able to communicate to as many people as possible, spread it, and if you can make it asymptomatic, at least for a period of time, while it is still communicable, that's really kind of the holy grail. In other words, if I have it and can't even be diagnosed as having it, and I can already be passing it to other people from, again, in this sick world of bioweapons design, that's a real coup. Well, yeah, this virus checks all of those boxes down down that list. So yes, so part of the reason why we can't just say, oh, hey, I guess it came from a seafood market. No, there needs to be an accounting for what's happened.
Sam Faddis, we have to pause for just a moment. We'll be right back with more on who else may be keen on this pandemic. It may shock you. That and more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're visiting with Charles Sam Faddis, a longtime friend of this program, very valued contributor. You can follow his writings these days at andmagazine.com. Also, check out his works of fiction and nonfiction. One of my personal favorites is Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, an agency in which he worked for some 20 years. Sam, I want to talk to you a little bit about the agency because it's come to my attention that back in October 2019, there was some sort of exercise, a relatively small number of people, but all it was apparently videotaped, and it's now available on the web, that indicates that several institutions and foundations and organizations that are very associated with what I would call the globalist camp or agenda came together to conduct something they called Event 201 in New York City. And it's kind of a who's who of people in that space. It's the Davos World Economic Forum. It's the Johns Hopkins University, which Michael Bloomberg has endowed massively. It's the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the UN Foundation. It's the Central Intelligence Agency. And also participating were the U.S. and Chinese Centers for Disease Control. And one of the things that is evident from the videotapes is that these folks were busily trying to figure out how do you build a global health entity, a sort of World Health Organization on steroids. How do you raise money for it in a sustained way? How do you essentially establish global governance, at least in this health space, using a pandemic as the vehicle to accomplish these long-standing goals? And it's pretty chilling when you go to the videotape, as they say, what these guys were talking about, how they kind of enthused about the possibility that what would be a crisis, not so much a health crisis, but a global crisis could be utilized to accomplish these various goals of fundraising for and otherwise empowering global governing institutions in the health space, I think probably among others. I'm sure that this kind of activity and what it's about from the globalists with a very strong, you know, sort of character of socialism inherited it as well, isn't surprising to you necessarily, but it is shocking nonetheless. And I just wonder what you make of it. And without suggesting necessarily that they were responsible for causing this pandemic, what you think about the prospect that they will, at the very least, be trying to capitalize upon this present pandemic to advance exactly that agenda?
Look, I think that somebody deliberately orchestrated this pandemic out of a star chamber somewhere? I do not. But I have no doubt that, in fact, there are There are people who look at everything these days through this lens of globalism, and they believe that the goal is break down these national boundaries, and the closer we can get to some sort of centralized world control, the better we are. I think most Americans are on exactly the other end of that spectrum, but there are very powerful people and interests out there all over the planet. That's their agenda. And they are no doubt looking at this crisis and saying exactly what you just suggested. Well, the answer to this is we need to be even more under the control of some sort of international body. We need to be even more fully integrated. Nations need to have less and less control over this. And that is, to me, that's just fact. That's the reality. Now, they don't always want to come out in the light of day and say that. In fact, most of the time, they don't want to come out in the light of day and say that. They'll couch it in other terms. But that's their agenda, just like there are people down at the CDC telling us right now that the answer is not that somebody should do their job. No, it's the Trump administration's fault, and we just need a bigger budget, and CDC needs to be more independent, and yada, yada. I mean, all the usual stuff.
I have to say, I'm watching with some horror of what's being cooked up in Congress, and it certainly seems as though at least some of the initiatives, while they're perhaps well-intentioned, bespeak this idea that let's grow government, let's have it take on more responsibility for managing people's lives and providing social safety nets. And it seems to me unlikely in the extreme, Sam Faddis, that we will see all of that disappearing once the crisis passes, hopefully in the very near future. But this is something that bears very considerable and close watching, I think, as to whether we will watch the globalist / socialist agenda being advanced in the name of dealing with this present crisis. And if so, folks, I hope you'll look back at some of the planning for just such an eventuality that was taking place just about 6 months ago. Sam, let me turn to one other topic that is very much involved, it seems, in the present economic vortex we find ourselves in as a result of, in part, the pandemic. And that is the contribution that's being made to our economic difficulties by the combined efforts of the Russians and the Saudis. It seems as though its purpose, though it's not always described this way, of a sort of a price war involving these two nations, is to take out the U.S. fracking industry, which has made such an incredible contribution to our economic security and caused both of those nations considerable difficulty. What do you think's going on there?
Well, I think you just hit the nail on the head. I mean, there is a price war, and it is a war to drive out competition, and that's the absolute reality. And I pause because I think it's clear from the tenor of my comments always, I'm not much for government intervention in the economy and that kind of thing. I think I'm philosophically opposed to it, and generally I think it's a disaster. But we got to keep in mind that this whole domestic fracking industry that we have now has been extraordinarily beneficial for the country from an economic standpoint and a national security standpoint, not inconsequential. And therefore, we ought to be, as a nation, looking at this and thinking, okay, we can't just let this happen. And I'm not prescribing a specific action, but we need to understand that, you know, you drive the fracking industry under, which is easier to do than most people might think, given cost margins and what it costs to produce. The negative impact is not just economic, and it's not just lost jobs, et cetera. It's taking us back to a day when we're completely dependent upon foreign sources of oil. When you're making decisions about sending troops to the Middle East, one of the factors you're weighing is, no, we literally have to go fight for the control of oil fields. We don't ever want to go back to that day, so we need to be concerned.
Well, and going back to what we were talking about at the top of the show, Sam Faddis, one of the takeaways, I think, for most Americans, if not virtually all of us, from the coronavirus and the insights that it's given us about our dependence upon China for critical things like medicines, for example, and a whole host of other supply chains that are directly tied to China, electronics to rare earth minerals to old drywall and baby formula and on, is that we don't want to be dependent on anybody else if we can possibly avoid it. And here is a case where we certainly can avoid it. And I was very gratified to see the president saying, you know, we're going to tap into this lowered price, take advantage of it, and fill up our strategic petroleum reserves. That seems to me to be a win-win for the country, helping keep those frackers in business and make sure that we've added dramatically to our resiliency against these sorts of threats in the future. I assume that's one of the things that you were heartened by as well, Sam. Anything else that we ought to be doing in this domain, do you think?
Well, I agree exactly with everything you just said about the strategic oil reserve, and then we'll see what else we need to do to sustain the industry. But your broader point, I think, is exceptionally well taken. The direction we need to go going forward is strategically is to get out of a position of being reliant upon foreign suppliers for anything important, and particularly not being exclusively reliant upon any one supplier. And if we could just add an exclamation point, and let's start with not being reliant upon an evil totalitarian communist regime for all of this stuff, right? If we get to start somewhere, let's stop fueling the world's largest, most tyrannical regime with our dollars. And let's go from there. The more we can bring this industry home, at a minimum back to Mexico, Canada, wherever, give us options. Don't let anybody have a stranglehold on us for anything.
Another idea is one that has been pursued by colleagues of ours at the Center for Security Policy is finding ways to take the fight to folks like the Russians and, for that matter, the Saudis by tapping into that enormous bounty of natural gas that we have to drive down their prices and otherwise push back on what they're doing with the funds that they have, which is generally threatening to us, in my experience. Sam, we have to pause for just one more second. We'll be right back with more for a final conversation with Sam Faddis for today on, among other things, the necessity in the light of this coronavirus for finally controlling our border. That and more, straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for our fourth and final installment with Sam Faddis, our guest today, talking about, well, a whole host of issues having to do with our public health, our national sovereignty, our economic security, and how all of these things seem to be in some jeopardy at the moment from enemies, foreign and, well, perhaps domestic as well. Sam, I did want to come back to something about this coronavirus that highlights some writing that you've been doing now for a good long time about the imperative of securing America's borders. They are still porous. President Trump has been trying manfully, I think it's fair to say, to get a wall built along the southern border where it's appropriate. He has been fought tooth and tongue over the 3 years of his presidency to date by the Democrats, primarily in opposition to that idea. Got some of it done anyway, by hook and by crook. Where do we stand on the vulnerability of our border? I saw, by the way, today that a number of the immigration judges and prosecutors have said they want to be shut down for the time being due to the public health crisis of the coronavirus. That isn't going to stop people from coming to or across that border, is it?
No. And if you talk about the border and talk about coronavirus, I think what the coronavirus does, kind of in the same way I suggested that it it helps us face the reality of how misguided our policy has been toward China in the last X number of decades. It does the same thing in regard to the border. I mean, here we are face to face with this pandemic, and everybody wants the president to be, you know, cutting contact with all sorts of countries, shutting down air travel, doing all these other things. And yet we, for decade after decade after decade, we have tolerated a situation in which effectively our southern border is largely uncontrolled. And we seriously have major political interests in this country who still want to advocate that basically anybody who wants to walk across that border should be allowed to walk across the border. And then, of course, be supported by us once they get here.
Healthcare, among other things.
Amongst everything. I mean, major Democratic candidates, that seems to be one of the few things in which they can agree. We got to give health care to all these people. Now, to start with, the coronavirus is going to be worldwide, so it doesn't really matter where you came from. But just to put this thing in relief, people walking across our southern border are not just people from Mexico or, for that matter, from Central America. In fact, I think it's the second, after Mexicans, the second largest group of individuals across the border in the last year or two has been Chinese. People show up from all over the planet, get into Mexico, come across that southern border. I mean, the Ninth Circuit, thank God the Supreme Court shut them down. But a couple of weeks ago, the Ninth Circuit told Donald Trump that his whole "you must wait in Mexico to have your asylum application processed" program, they were going to vacate it, that which meant that 60,000 people sitting in Tijuana waiting to process their asylum claims would simply all be allowed to walk across the southern border. At the height of a pandemic, we got a court that was going to order us to let 60,000 totally unknown individuals all come into the United States.
Most of whom have been congregating for a while on the other side of that border.
Share whatever one guy had, they all have it now. And let's also keep in mind that we know statistically that almost none of them will actually ever turn out to have a valid asylum claim. We also know that once they're in the United States and they're released, which is what happens to them, almost none of them will ever show up for a subsequent hearing. And yet we had a court in the middle of this whole thing seriously say, yeah, you need to just let those 60,000 people walk across the border.
It's insane. And as you said, thank God that the Supremes were able to interpose an objection and at least I think get a stay of execution here. One of the other heartening things I have to say about the Trump presidency, of course, is the fact that he has almost balanced the number of judges that are on that Ninth Circuit. So hopefully heretofore, these kinds of rulings will be fewer and fewer, if present at all. Sam, I did want to talk about one other thing that has just developed over the weekend. For those of us who haven't been following Israeli politics terribly closely, this may come as a surprise, but the Prime Minister of Israel, now for many years, Benjamin Netanyahu, seemed to have won the last election, finally, having, you know, gone through two previous cycles inconclusively. And yet the president of Israel has just invited his opponent to try to put together a government. Not clear that he'll be able to do it, but with the help of Arab parties, who, as I best can tell, aren't actually allowed to be part of a government. I mean, they sit in the parliament and so on, but they're not actually able to run things in the government. They, the so-called blue and white party, seems to have a possible majority. I don't know if you're following this terribly closely, Sam. I know you've spent a lot of time in the Middle East, and you certainly have an appreciation for how important for our security, you know, a secure Israel is. But tell us what we should make of this extraordinary development.
Well, I was never stationed in Israel. I've done a lot of work with the Israelis and been in and out of Israel numerous times. So I've been following it to a certain extent. I mean, here's the thing. I think most Americans look at the situation. They look at Israel. They're looking at it, obviously, through the lens of foreign policy, what our relationship is to them, how it affects their national security. Netanyahu fundamentally is under fire, well, based on corruption charges, which may or may not be valid, but it's all domestic politics. And so there seems to be this disconnect from our standpoint, an attack on Netanyahu equals an attack on Israel. He's being torn down. That's a threat to us. I don't know whether he's going to survive. He's a tenacious guy. Every time you declare him dead, he resurrects himself and comes out on top. So he may yet win this fight when it's all said and done. That said, if he ultimately is forced to step aside, you know, here's what I think. When the dust clears, after whatever interim period there is, Israel is going to end up in the same position as far as what we're concerned about. I mean, but in the meantime, I would not count the man out. He's just one of those guys that his opponents are always claiming that they've got the upper hand on him. And then, you know, the next thing you know, he's got them in a headlock. So we'll see where where this goes.
Well, I hope that's the case in this instance, because in the end, whether Israel is more or less in the same position, as far as we're concerned, remains somewhat to be seen. I think you're right. In general, there seems now to be a fairly strong consensus within Israel, for example, about Iran and the Palestinians and so on. But I fear that domestic politics have a way of interposing problems for foreign policy, heavens knows. And this may well be another example of it if we're not careful. Sam Faddis, I wanted to ask you one last thing. One of the things that, of course, has been of concern to us here in the United States, and I think has not gotten enough attention, is the phenomenon of the enemy within. And I just wonder, as you have been looking at the various elements, whether they're what I call Sharia supremacists, so the Muslim Brotherhood types, whether it's the Antifas, the radical leftists, the socialists slash communists, or, you know, what we're always told is the real threat, namely the white supremacists. How do you characterize the magnitude of these problems and particularly the relative contribution these groups are making to insecurity here at home?
Well, I think there are a number of threats you ticked off, particularly, for instance, Islamic threats, that a lot of the media just simply dismisses. And make the point I've made many times before when I'm talking on the air. I'm not attacking all Muslims. I certainly am an opponent and spent most of my life fighting radical jihadists and Islamists and people who are looking to forcibly transform our culture. And that's a major threat. But, I mean, you know, you didn't mention this, but let me throw out a related piece. There is active inside this country a massive Iran lobby. They have organizations on Capitol Hill. Senior members of that organization were in the White House 33 times before we drafted that great Iran nuclear deal, contributing to its drafting. You want to talk about foreign influence? When you have representatives of the Iranian government walking in the White House to help draft our draft of that nuclear deal, that's pretty terrifying. And yet it is reality. And I see those guys on television all the time, and yet nobody calls them out. They pretend to be independent of the Iranian government, and we ignore them, and I'll let them parade around Washington, D.C.
And exercise influence, even inside the delegation that was negotiating the deal over there, and not just in our councils here. Sam Faddis, this hour has flown by, as it always does with you. I appreciate so much your time and your expertise, your clarity about these various challenges that we're facing and what we need to be doing about it. And Magazine is a wonderful platform for your views. I hope people are following it closely, andmagazine.com. And obviously, we cherish our time with you. I hope you'll be back with us again very soon. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. I hope the rest of you will be back with us very soon as well. Same time, same station tomorrow. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.